Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Ken Weitzma is a pastor of Antioch in Bend, Oregon. He's president of Kilns College. He's also an author, and today we're going to talk with him about his book, The Grand Paradox, The Messiness of Life, The Mystery of God, and The Necessity of Faith. Ken, welcome to LifeQuest.
It's great to be with you.
Why did you write this book at this time?
Well, at this time is an interesting question. I think it was really the culmination or summation of all I've learned in the last 20 years kind of on the Christian life or how to pursue God. And so really kind of wanted to barrel it into one book and try and articulate it. So kind of cobbled it together, and in a lot of ways, kind of the sticker on the front cover of the book sums it up for me. It's supposed to be a contemporary guide on pursuing God.
And you use this word paradox. Describe for our listeners what that means to you.
Paradox is a great word. We see the paradoxes throughout Scripture. You die to live, or you give to gain, or you serve to lead. And Jesus himself kind of put it out there that if you seek your life, you'll lose it, but if you lose your life for his sake, you're going to find it. So it's really counterintuitive, very paradoxical, and the word paradox is just a better way of saying tension, which I think is inherent in faith.
Yeah.
That if you're walking by sight, it's all clear, it's pretty easy and straightforward. If you're walking by faith, that means that there's by necessity confusion, lack of clarity, maybe it's illogical, or you can't see the outcome, and there's a certain amount of tension that comes with that. And so the grand paradox is really just talking about what that actually looks like in real life, that tension kind of shooting straight when you put it all on the table. The Christian walk or the Christian life, living by faith, is an awkward, a beautifully awkward reality.
And it is a reality. In chapter 3, right at the beginning, you describe a situation that I had, and that was I went to a Christian high school, a Christian college and university, and there were a lot of Christians, except a lot of people didn't act like Christians. That seems to be part of what we're living in North America anyway.
Yeah, and the subtitle of the book, The Messiness of Life, The Mystery of God, and The Necessity of Faith, is really kind of setting the two poles that we think life should be cleaner than it is, mm-hmm. simpler than it is. We're always trying to fight against it. If we just get over the next hill, it's going to finally kind of smooth out and life will be, better than mess. And then God, we think he should be less mysterious. God should explain himself more, speak more directly, more often. And we're always trying to get kind of our faith to act like that. And when we realize that life just isn't like that, the psalmists are perfect this way. Life is messy. God is mysterious. And so when we walk forward, we walk in that tension, in that awkward reality. And I think when Christianity becomes less than that, we're making it some kind of a cultural reality, mm-hmm. some kind of a creedal thing that just simply says, of all the different boxes I can check as to my religion or the kind of faith of my fathers, I check this box. Culturally, I'm a Christian. And when that's the total of your belief, then faith in God just simply means I believe he might exist, rather than faith in God meaning with all of my life, I'm walking forward day by day into the future, choosing to follow God, even if it doesn't make sense, even if sin seems like it'll feel better, even if the crowd seems to be pulling me the other way, even if logic tells me that I'm going to get better results by kind of choosing something different. True Christian faith necessarily works itself out into our actions and the way we live our life moving forward.
It's a heart commit. Whether I'm good at it or not, whether I fail or not, is a matter of kind of working itself out in grace, but it's the pre-commitment. Am I really choosing to follow God with my life? In other words, my life belongs to him. Or am I really choosing to try and find my own way with a little bit of God or religion sprinkled in? And then there's a whole chapter on the will of God in the book, and I say this. We're always asking the question, what is God's will for my life?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we should be asking the question, what is God's will with my life? And so he would much rather we try and fit our life into his plan for the world than to ask him what his plan is for our life. And so we really individualized or privatized faith. And this whole kind of book is looking at Scripture and saying, what does it mean if we were to actually kind of re-toggle that or do a paradigm shift and understand what discipleship really looked like, the way Jesus practiced it with his
son. One of the key things that you bring out in chapter 4 with this quote from Brother Lawrence is that this continual conversation with God, and so all of a sudden prayer in that definition becomes a real daily, hourly thing.
It really does. That whole chapter is on prayer, and you know, I got burned out on prayer when it was just this kind of awkward rote thing. You know, you're in a group and someone says pray for the person on your left, or you're sitting there in a prayer group and someone's praying about Aunt Mildred's big toe.
Yeah.
You know, and that they're going to do good on their test the next day, and you're dreaming about who knows what. And it really begins to feel like we're just lobbing up requests to God. We're never really listening, and we're never really expecting that other than him giving us things we want, that there's some kind of a word he can speak in to guide us. And I think the way Paul talked about prayer and the way Jesus modeled it, Paul talked about praying without ceasing, and Jesus spent these nights with God. I mean, he could have in 5 minutes' time thrown up the things he needed. What he was doing, though, in communing with God was filling his soul and listening and seeking God's guidance. And then in the morning, he tells his disciples, you know, I know you want to go to that house and heal more people, but it's time for us to leave. And so I think when we really understand what fellowship with the Spirit means and this relationship that's available with God, prayer is going to be so much deeper than this kind of community-based prayer where we really individually want to get alone and spend time with God to commune and to seek out wisdom, to listen, to kind of open it all up to him and not just throw up three or four requests and then wait around to see if he's going to answer them.
Opening up your heart to God as you would to a friend, someone said. I have four daughters, and I have learned that they're not particularly interested in my lectures of what I want of them, but that if I listen to them, all of a sudden they tell me what I need to hear from them, and some things I don't want to hear.
Absolutely, and I think if we understood how little we understand about life compared to God, then I think we would be, instead of spending 90% of the time talking, 10% listening,
mm-hmm.
It'd be the other way. We'd be spending 10% of the time talking and 90% of the time listening to a God who knows us better than we know ourselves, who understands our situation kind of from a higher perspective, and then even can give better advice than what we can give him. So yeah, it's really trying to rethink, what does that look like? And it's really funny. I said this recently in a church service that sometimes you'll meet people that have just become Christians 2 months ago,
mm-hmm.
and they'll say, "I've actually heard from God. I mean, maybe this very deep sense that God spoke a word or communicated to me and kind of pointed a direction." And you can speak to Christians that have been Christians for 20 years. And they'll say they've never felt
right.
kind of a strong word from God or a clear leading. And when you hold those two side by side, the one difference I would say is the person 2 months a Christian went and got alone with God and sat in silence, and that's the difference. And the Christian that had been a Christian for 20 years just never found that time to really wait on the Lord. And so I think that's just one of those things we got to recapture as Christians, that discipline of trying to find time and space to build that relationship with God.
Pastor, one of the passions of your life is justice, biblical justice. And you have this justice conference that you're the founder of. In your chapter here, you say you define social justice. You know, there are some people that look down on what they call the social gospel and caring about people who don't have this or that or the other. And yet you're saying it's part of the character of God.
Yeah, I think we're learning what we did wrong kind of with the split that happened 100 years ago between
mm-hmm.
the conservative and liberal stripes. And the reality is, you know, one side of that divide took kind of the care and concern, this is a broad generalization, but kind of took the justice part, society part,
and the other side took the we're going to preach Jesus, we're going to have strong doctrine and truth part.
Yeah.
And the reality is we love false dichotomies, we love either ors, we love extremes in the Christian world, but both of those things are a necessary part of what it means to exemplify the character of God or the character of Christ. We don't have the option of picking one and leaving the other. I like to say you can't have Jesus and not justice, because justice is a part of his character.
Mm-hmm.
So to try and say, I'm just going to have just Jesus, well, what makes Jesus Jesus is his love, that he cares about the kingdom of God, that he's willing to die for it, that it could be reconciled back to God, you know, and the example, the command he left to love one another. So everything about Jesus exudes this idea of a social ethic of love and justice, and so we don't have the option of neglecting that. Even the Old Testament doesn't leave us the option, the orphan, the widow,
right.
The alien, the poor. But these things are things that are a necessary component of what it means to please God or to follow God. So I'm trying to just help people see it from a biblical standpoint so that they won't be afraid of it, won't be scared by the word justice, but they'll realize that this is just a biblical word, and it's a necessary part of what it means to be a Christian.
And another thing that Christians are afraid of is this feeling and this term doubt. How can I have doubt if I'm a real Christian? And you suggest
absolutely.
That all of a sudden we have to confront a lot of problems, evil in the world, suffering. Why did God permit that? But I like what you put here when you say answers don't necessarily help.
No, they don't. The messiness of life, you know, creates context for doubt. Walking by faith means there's a lack of clarity, and a lack of clarity causes us to reflect or to doubt or to be unsure. And that's a natural part of life. I mean, the psalmist, if you listen to the psalmist and sometimes even the prophets, there's this grasping or groping for God and the confusion that they have. And so in this modern Christian world, we have this kind of idea that if someone talks about doubt, there's something wrong with them,
uh-huh.
and we're going to shun them. I would never admit that in public, that I have doubts. And again, it's because we have this false notion of faith that says if you're doubting, it means you don't believe that God exists. Rather, doubt is a much broader thing that just says, right now, I'm uncertain, you know, I'm confused. So I think that doubt is the atmosphere, the context in which faith operates. So doubt is to a fire like oxygen would be to a fire. Faith needs doubt in order for it to really be faith. And so I think it's illustrated with Mother Teresa. A lot of Christians I know, when her diaries were made public, and all of a sudden we see that she had these doubts.
Yeah.
She struggled with the hiddenness of God. People kind of were like, wow, well, if Mother Teresa doubted, well, then what chance is there for me to really believe that God exists? And I actually think it's a beautiful example of faith. And so I think the example of Mother Teresa is not one of doubt, but it's of faith. And what I mean by that is it's a beautiful thing that she had a spiritual director or a mentor or someone that she could confess her doubts to. That's
mm-hmm.
something that we've lost kind of in the Protestant world.
Right.
I also think it's beautiful that she had the discipline of journaling and that she would write out her prayers and struggle with this kind of the hiddenness of God or the presence of suffering as she's burying, you know, people, children, boys and girls in Calcutta. And so I think in this picture where she's articulating these doubts, the fact that at the end she always walked forward in faith, she always trusted God, and she continued, she committed, she made that decision, that choice to walk forward. That's the example of the psalmist. God, I don't know where you are. God, I don't understand this. Yet I will trust in you. Yet I will believe. And so I think Mother Teresa's example is actually a beautiful example of faith that gives us a pattern of how we, in the midst of our confusion or mess or doubt or the big suffering kind of questions in the world, that like her, we can continue to walk forward faithfully. And that's the picture of faith.
You help us walk through some truisms, if I can use that word, in much of our Christian faith. God is in control no matter what the tragedy is that happened, or what is God's plan for my life. And you suggest in a number of circumstances we turn that on its head.
Yeah, I think that I think that when we really dive deep into these subjects, a lot of what's confusing or what has kind of bothered us or irritated us kind of falls away. And it's not falling away by being answered. It's falling away because we realize at the end of the day, we have to have faith in God. We demand answers, but what God demands is faith. And so even Job didn't get his answers that he was looking for, but his tension resolved in the end. Well, how did it resolve? It resolved because what he got was the presence of God.
Mm-hmm.
And so the same is true for us. We have all these questions, all these fears, and we come to God, and we may not get our answers, but if we get the presence of God, if we get God himself, then we're going to say, you know what? Despite not having the answers, despite not understanding it, I'll walk forward, I'll continue to live by faith, and I'll trust that somehow God will redeem this or will show me in the end kind of the logic behind it that I don't understand now. And one last part to that is I feel like that modern Christians, when we get right into the middle, the crucible of suffering, we jettison faith and we go look to yoga or physical fitness or Buddhism or sinning. You know, we go try and sin or whatever we can to kind of get out of this crucible of faith because God obviously failed me because look at the suffering I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
And what I counsel people is if you bail out in that crucible of suffering, it means you're never going to be around at the end of the day to see how God could redeem that part of the story or whatever God might explain into that story that would make it all kind of change and come about. And so in the middle of kind of the dark nights or the difficult times, there's that need to continue on, to press forward, to continue to live by faith, knowing that if God is a good God, he will, in his time, in due course, show us how he used that, how he's going to redeem it, or how he's bigger than it, and somehow it'll be okay anyways. And so that's something that faith teaches.
And this filters down into kind of a every day or every week thing of looking for what you quote C.S. Lewis as saying, a suitable church. This buffet of Christianity. And in a metro area like where I live, I mean, there's all kinds of choices. If you don't like the music in one church or the length of the sermons or whatever, you can always find one that seems to fit you like a glove.
Yeah, and the modern church is a hard thing. And I wrote that chapter really to try to help dive back into what the idea of church was supposed to be. I mean, if faith is this walking forward, trusting that God somehow has a plan,
mm-hmm.
then it's going to show up in our understanding of heaven and the afterlife. It's going to show up in our understanding of suffering. And it's also going to show up in this thing called church, this messy reality with messy people that God seems to have called us to. And if it's his plan A, you know, there's really no plan B. And today, because we've individualized the whole experience,
mm-hmm.
there's always something to critique. There's something that's not good enough about the leader, not good enough about the structures, not good enough about the other people, or they let me down, or someone might have gossiped about me. There's always a reason to be hurt by the church. And sometimes it really is bad, and people get wounded, and we have to figure out how to bandage them up. But with most of life, it's saying that in that messiness, learning to forgive other people, learning to overlook an offense, learning to accept them for who they are, learning that you're doing the same things to hurt other people that other people may be doing to hurt you, and somehow coming together and saying community is going to be forged out of that messy reality, that's something that God has called us to, that he believes is a necessary part of the Christian life. And if God has called us to it, even if we don't understand it, faith means we accept that and we commit to it and walk forward. And that's a much different posture of serving and committing to do church in obedience than going to church and saying, I'm going to evaluate it based on how it's meeting my needs or suiting my taste.
And I like this heading in one of your chapters, More God, Less Advice. And you know, Pastor Ken, 30 years ago, I was a lot smarter than I was now because people would ask me questions and I'd have 5 Bible texts and 3 illustrations. And now I talk to them about what does God mean to you?
Yeah, one of the things I give readers permission to do in this book is actually to shut the book and put it away and say that, unfortunately, you know, this book and other books could be a part of the problem, not a part of the solution.
And so in some ways we have to put the things that are noisy around us down so we can hear from God himself. And at the end of the day, whatever situation I'm in, giving advice, whether it's counseling or even a friend or family member, I try to always end it by saying, at the end, you know, you're going to have to live with your decision, not me. And you need to go to God and pray it through and seek his guidance. Because at the end of the day, that's what you really want, is you want to feel like God is leading you. You want to feel a sense of confidence or peace that he's with you in the decision, even if you make the wrong decision. And so no matter how wise my words are, there's something that's so much better than that.
The book is The Grand Paradox, Contemporary Guide on the Pursuit of God by Pastor Ken Weitzma. Ken, where can our listeners get a copy of your book?
You can get a copy at Amazon.com or go into your local Borders and look for it on the shelf. If it's not there, you can always ask them to order it for you. Or you can go to my blog at kenweitzma.com, and the last name, which is Dutch, is spelled W-Y-T-S-M-A, kenweitzma.com. And I've got some information on the book there and all the different places you can order it. But it should be wherever books are sold.
Thank you, Pastor. Appreciate you being with us today on LifeQuest.
Appreciate you having me.
I hope you've enjoyed this interview with Pastor Ken Weitzma. Again, the book is called The Grand Paradox. If you would like a copy of this book, I have three of them to give away. So the first three of you who send me an email with your name and address, I will send you a copy. And that email address is lifequest@lifetalk.net. If you want a copy of today's interview book, The Grand Paradox, send me an email, lifequest@lifetalk.net, and you'll receive it in the mail. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net.